The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Tomorrow is the celebrated day that America has devoted to mothers. It is a secular holiday, meaning that it was instituted by society. It was not instituted by God or His church. And for this reason, Mother's Day is observed by both non-believers and believers alike. And we are aware that the Church of God in our age has long recognized Mother's Day and Father's Day and Thanksgiving Day as acceptable holidays, and not that they're sanctified. They are not set aside for a holy purpose. There's not a holy convocation during these days, but that they are acceptable to observe or mark. Still, there is a sense, I think, of properness about them because of what they stand for, and Mother's Day actually points to an appreciation for the mothers and the mother-type figures that have affected each of our personal lives. And that holiday tomorrow does not point to a particular church, it does not point to a goddess, but it points to the women who have affected each of us through their maternal role of tenderness, of affection, of service to other people, and even care to their children as a parent. However, because Mother's Day is not a day that was established by God, some believe that Christians should not observe it. In addition, some actually claim that Mother's Day has ties to the Catholic and Protestant observance of Mothering Sunday, and possibly even linked to the worship of some female deities in ancient times. So, to give some peace, if you will, to some what might be some uneasy minds, I think I would like to begin with a bit of a history lesson regarding Mother's Day. And so, Mothering Sunday, as it has been insinuated by some, this is a holiday celebrated by Catholics and Protestants in some parts of Europe, not in all, but in some parts of Europe. It falls on the fourth Sunday during Lent, which is 3 weeks before Easter. The first records of this observance go back to the 16th century, and at that time, people were instructed by their church to return to their quote-unquote mother church, the place where they were baptized, in order to observe this day. Now, more often, people simply went to the local parish or the local cathedral, whatever was closest to them, and people that observed this day were said to have gone a-mothering. Much earlier than this, in Roman times, a day was observed referred to as Lady Day, which occurred on the vernal equinox. And this day was symbolically equated with the mythical resurrection of Attis. And consequently, Romans celebrated what was called the Feast of Hilaria, dedicated to their mother goddess Cybele. Now, Hilaria was preceded by approximately 2 weeks of fasting, likened to Mothering Sunday, which was celebrating during this time of Lent. Of course, we know it was kind of a half-hearted fast and that they only abstained from certain foods and not fasted with gone without food and water altogether. And so we begin to see, therefore, where the Catholics actually developed their Mothering Sunday. Lady Day actually later became what was called the Feast of Annunciation on March 25th, where Catholics marked at this time, the visit of the angel Gabriel to the Virgin Mary and told her that she would bring forth and be the mother of the Son of God. In latter times, Mothering Sunday became a day when domestic servants were given a day off. They were instructed to visit their mother, quote-unquote, mother church, and people incorporated their own mothers into this observance, and they would bring along their moms and other family members as they went to church. It's said that children would pick wildflowers along the way to place in the halls of the building, or they would give them to their mothers. And this religious tradition evolved into a tradition of giving gifts to mothers. Now, because of the similarity of terms, when researching this, you can see because of some of the similarity regarding mothers, some would automatically connect America's observance to one or more of these days that were observed by Catholics, Protestants, or the Romans. However, unlike Christmas and Easter and Halloween and Valentine's Day and some of these other secular holidays, Mother's Day and even Father's Day, as observed in this country, are not connected to any of these holidays, which clearly have false religious ties. Mother's Day, in fact, in America was first celebrated in the 20th century, and it was when a woman by the name of Anna Jarvis, she held a memorial for her own mother. And this memorial took place, it did take place in a Methodist church, and it honored the life of Ann Reeves Jarvis, her mother, who was a peace activist, who was also a nurse, and she cared for the wounded soldiers on both sides of the American Civil War. Now, this mother that was honored at that time created what was called Mother's Day work clubs, and they were designed to address public health issues. Anna Jarvis wanted to honor her mother in some way, and she wanted to do so by not only marking a day, but by continuing to carry on her work, which she thought was honorable work. And so her campaign to create a Mother's Day was recognized in the United States and began in 1905, and this was the same year that her mother had died. Now, there were never any religious connotations to the day Anna lobbied for, and the only connection we see upon researching this is that there was a memorial held for Anna's own mother in the halls of a Methodist church, but it was not marked as a religious day at all, and it wasn't marked as a day where people should go to church and worship. It wasn't until 1908 when the United States Congress really put this on their table, but they rejected this proposal of Mother's Day as an official holiday. They even joked about it, saying that, well, if we do this, we're going to have to create a Mother-in-Law's Day as well. But by 1911, all United States observed the holiday, with some of them officially recognizing Mother's Day as a local holiday. And then in 1914, President Woodrow Wilson signed a proclamation designating Mother's Day to be held on the second Sunday in May. And this was to be a national holiday where people would honor their own mothers. Now, interestingly, Anna Jarvis, who started this movement, and even though she was successful in the endeavor, by the 1920s, she was quite disappointed with how Mother's Day was being observed because it became very commercialized, and that it was not her intent at all. It was to be more of an intimate a day set aside for mothers and those people who cared about them. So it's important to note that Anna Jarvis never mentioned Mothering Sunday. She never mentioned any connection to any particular church, particularly the Catholic Church or the Protestant churches. Neither Anna nor the United States government proclaimed or even insinuated that people need to go to church worship on the Sunday that is set aside as Mother's Day. And the fact that they chose the second Sunday in May as opposed to 3 weeks before Easter is further evidence that there are no ties to the European celebrations beginning in the 16th century, nor are there any relations to the ancient Roman observances of Lady Day or this supposed feast of Hilaria. I wonder if they did a lot of laughing during that, you know, hilarious. I don't know if that's where the expression came from, but in addition, while Anna Jarvis may have been associated with a Methodist faith, she did not support the worship of false gods. In other words, if the scriptures would have said, do not set aside a day to honor your mother or your father, she would not have worked to institute a day honoring them. She never tried to make Mother's Day a church holiday, but simply a day where everyone would pause and they would consider those important women in their lives that affected them positively. And so the opinion that Mother's Day is celebrated in America was meant to be a religious celebration actually has no evidence to back up such a claim. It's just that. It's an opinion. Now, the American holiday of Mother's Day was soon adopted after it was declared by President Woodrow Wilson, and many other countries around the world began to adopt an observance of a Mother's Day. And in different parts of the world, the date was changed to fit already existing holidays that some of them which honored motherhood. And so people from Ireland and also from the United Kingdom, for example, some of them started celebrating Mother's Day on what was known to them as Mothering Sunday. And in fact, in some of these places, the two celebrations became so mixed up that people don't even know which one was the other. They consider them both just the same type of a holiday. And of course, in my mind, I'm thinking, well, if I lived in one of these parts where they considered Mother's Day a day to devote it to your mothers and celebrate it on Mothering Sunday, I would not keep it on that day. But that's not the case in America here. In our country, it was never so. And so the conclusion from this research is that nothing, I think, even hints that Jarvis had any intention of pointing to a female deity, of pointing to a mother church, which did occur in other parts of the world. And so the modern holiday that we know as Mother's Day, it's an American invention, and it's not linked to the worship of Virgin Mary, it's not linked to Sybil or any other religious organization. And even though the scriptures tell us to learn not the way of the heathen, we have to remember that those instructions God had given was learning the ways that those people worshiped their gods and trying to use them to worship the true God. And so that particular scripture is truly not applicable to the observance of Mother's Day or Father's Day or Thanksgiving Day. But there is another argument by some, and it's a belief that we should not observe anything unbelievers observe. I mean, after all, the scriptures do point to us being a part of the world, but not in the world, but I should say, but not a part of the world. Do not be partakers of its ways or of its sins. And so some would say that, well, no matter what holiday it is, if it's not created by God, it should not be marked or acknowledged at all by God's people. But such a belief actually does not consider the fact that Christians do many things that unbelievers do that are not actually wrong. An example can be given. Well, because the pagans may have danced, should we refrain from any form of dance? Well, the answer is no. Dance doesn't mean dancing is wrong. There are certain types of dances that are wrong and certain ways in which are times in which people dance that are wrong. But dancing itself is not something that should be avoided. Because unbelievers have fall harvest festivals where they enjoy a meal together, does that mean that we should never enjoy a cheerful meal with family and friends during the fall? No, it doesn't mean that at all. We would not choose to do so on certain days that others might observe holidays that we know are linked to days that are wrong, like Halloween, for example, but it doesn't mean we can't have, you know, a cheerful meal with one another. Native Americans is another example. They honor their elders in traditional ways, but that does not mean that we should not honor our elderly. You know, we would not do so with some kind of ritual or some kind of religious ceremony or adopt some pagan tradition. But we should honor our elders and our parents in respect and with kindness and, you know, paying attention to their needs or their concerns and to learn from the wisdom that they might be able to share with us. And though it might sound cliche when we consider all of these things that I mentioned so far, a question could be asked is, what would Jesus do? You know, would Christ have anything to do with the observance of Mother's Day or Father's Day as observed in America today? Well, an answer, if you go over to John 10, an answer can be derived from a holiday created by Israel. The people of Israel returned from their captivity in Babylon, and they began construction on the second temple. And this was a significant event in the history of God's people, and it took 20 years for them to complete. The people had periods of zeal, and they also had times of half-heartedness. Once the temple was completed, it stood strong for hundreds of years, but it was eventually overrun and desecrated by Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, the Jews suffered greatly at that time. They were terribly persecuted. Many of them were murdered in the streets. But there was a revolt that began by a man and his family, a man known as Judas Maccabeus. And this small insurrection turned into a significant movement and a monumental point in history of God's faithful people. This small band eventually formed, and they gathered many thousands of people together, but still relatively small compared to the forces they were fighting against. And they eventually retook the temple, and they cleansed it, and they rededicated the temple on the 25th of Kislev in 164 BC. Now, I'm going to read a little portion of this in 1 Maccabees chapter 4, in verse 52. It says, early in the morning on the 25th day of the ninth month, which is the month of Kislev, In the 148th year, they rose and offered sacrifice as the law directs on the new altar of burnt offering that they had built. At the very season, on the very day that the Gentiles had profaned it, it was dedicated with songs and harps and lutes and cymbals. All the people fell on their faces and worshipped and blessed heaven, who had prospered them. So they celebrated the dedication for the altar for 8 days, and they joyfully offered burnt offerings. They offered a sacrifice of well-being, a thanksgiving offering. They decorated the front of the temple with golden crowns and small shields. They restored the gates and the chambers for the priests and fitted them with doors. And there was a very great joy among the people, and the disgrace brought by the Gentiles was removed. Then Judas and his brothers and all the assembly of Israel determined that every year at that season, the days of dedication of the altar should be observed with joy and gladness for 8 days, beginning with the 25th day of the month of Kislev. And so this dedication that was instituted at that time, it became a national holiday. It was not instituted by God, and yet God recognized it as appropriate. And part of the evidence of that is shown here in John 10, and beginning in verse 22, it says, now it was the feast of dedication, speaking of that which I just read about in Jerusalem, and it was winter, and Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. Now this is, some would just read over this and not think much of it, but the feast of dedication was this holiday created by the nation or the people of Israel at that time. It is something that actually could be considered secular holiday because it was not a holy day. It was not a commanded religious observance, a commanded holy convocation added to it. It did involve something significant for God's people, and it did involve the temple in Jerusalem. However, God did not declare this holiday, but he did not reject it. And we see then that if Christ did not approve of anyone marking this holiday, the Feast of Dedication, he would have said something about it. He would have made mention that this was not appropriate. If he thought it was wrong to acknowledge anything, therefore, outside of God's designated holidays, we see that Christ would not have been at the temple at that time during the celebration, and he offered no words of condemnation about this feast of dedication. And I think that his very presence actually shows that it was a stamp of approval. But again, not marking it a holy day, but still saying, well, this is an appropriate holiday, to appropriate moment in time in history to remember. Zechariah in chapter 8. So we see that there are holidays other than God's days that can be recognized, not equated to God's days, but recognized, acknowledged. We should never hold them in the same regard as God's feasts. They are special. It's entirely separate and special from any holiday created by men. But there are times of observance that can simply be marked or acknowledged, but in a lesser way. And the question has been posed then if Mother's Day would be observed in the millennium, because we see people, you know, in the Church of God marking it today, acknowledging it today. Would such a day actually be observed in the kingdom of God when it comes to this earth? Well, the answer is simply we cannot know. We don't know for sure, but there is an example showing us that some man-made observances will be retained. And so the Jewish people created certain fast days to observe the solemnity of their suffering down through the ages. And these were man-made observances. They were not things that God told them to institute. And the question is, will any of them, any of those fast days that they created, be kept? Will they carry over into the millennium? Well, the Bible indicates that some will, but they will be kept in a different spirit. Zechariah 8 in verse 3, just to give a little context here, it says, thus says the Eternal, I will return to Zion and dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Jerusalem shall be called the City of Truth, the Mountain of the Eternal of Hosts, the Holy Mountain. And so we see here that the context is clearly millennial, a time when Christ returns to this earth. And if you go down to verse 19, it says, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, the fast of the fourth month, and the fast of the fifth, and the fast of the seventh, and the fast of the tenth, these shall be joy and gladness, and cheerful feasts for the house of Judah. So these were times of mourning, fasting, of remembering terrible things that happened, but they shall be changed. They will become joyful feasts or observances. And so we see that there are certain days that are likely going to be retained or carry over into the millennium, but they will be changed. And they are not going to become like God's holy days, like God's feasts. And we see then that the reason that some of these might be retained is because they are not of pagan origin. There's nothing connected to them that is tied to false religion in any way. So once men and women around the world come under the umbrella of God's government, it's possible that some would be allowed to set aside a day to ensure that their populace or their parents might be honored and remembered. And it seems that God would not refuse such a request, you know, as long as it didn't attempt to become a religious observance. And if such a scenario does or take place, certainly people would not choose to have a Mother's Day or a Father's Day or a Parents' Day or what have you. They would not choose to have them during God's holy days. They would not choose to even have them on the Sabbath. It would be simply be a day set aside to honor their parents in some way. And of course, people would say, well, we should be honoring our parents all year long. And we certainly should, shouldn't we? But the sad truth is, most do not. We tend to forget. And so I hope that this would satisfy concerns that some might have. The fact that there is almost nothing in this world that hasn't been tainted in some way. Almost anything that man has put his hands to seems to be tainted in some way. And so we should be very cautious. And, you know, I don't think it's upsetting or ridiculous for people to propose a question because people are being cautious and they should consider, is there something about this that should be avoided? But just because of the fact that almost everything is tainted or touched in some way, it makes it difficult for us, doesn't it, to navigate through life. But we can navigate through life. We can do so with the word of truth. We can do so by the Spirit of God. And we can, therefore, with these tools, if you will, try not to be self-righteous over much. Because sometimes I think people try to insinuate something because they are trying to be righteous over much. But when it comes to Mother's Day, to Father's Day, and to Thanksgiving Day, or the 4th of July, when it's connected to the United States of America, these are not related to a church. They are not related to a pagan god. And because of this, the Church of God in our age has long seen as it's not inappropriate to acknowledge them. And of course, we always encourage people not to go overboard with their celebrations, because that is what people tend to do, to turn it into a big party or something a little extravagant instead of keeping it more simple and humble and more personal and intimate. So we can honor our parents, you know, by sending them a card or some flowers or taking them out to lunch or dinner, or spending the afternoon or evening with them is entirely appropriate. But many people have turned it into some kind of a festive celebration where, you know, excessive drinking might take place, and Anna Jarvis, in fact, recognized this and was very disappointed, even in the 1920s, that people were turning it into something that it was never meant to be. Instead, we should use the day to be grateful to those people that mean so much to us, those people that were either our biological mothers or served as mother-type figures in our lives. And I think it should also then remind us of God's command to honor our parents consistently. You know, not just to send a card or some flowers or a box of chocolates one day a year, but to try to do something for them more frequently. Of course, this has become sort of a problem to those people who do not live near their parents. I mean, my parents, for example, live 1,300 miles away from here, and I haven't seen them in almost 2 years, I believe, maybe over 2 years by now. And I would love to see my mom every day, take her out to lunch occasionally and just talk with her and chat with her and share some of these thoughts. And but it's not always possible, but we can do what we can. We can call them more often. You know, we have the technology to be able to keep that connection there. We have Skype, live video streaming when it's working properly. A lot of people have trouble with that, and my parents have trouble with it as well. The point is, if it's possible, we should be doing more to acknowledge them than simply waiting for one day a year to roll around. Proverbs 6 Consider the relationship between a mother and her children. This is to be intimately special. It was designed to be a nurturing connection where love is given through numerous acts of tending and mending and preparing and comforting and reprimanding at times, correcting, drying the tears though, doing so out of love, and washing and teaching and what have you. The list could go on and on. I mean, the mother's to-do list and her workload is always quite large, enormous, I think. But to many of us, I think it cannot be comprehended the amount of care and the amount of devotion that went into mothers carrying a child in their womb for 9 long months. And during that time, the women made their children a priority for them. And most mothers, after children were born, most mothers and fathers gave up personal ambitions, hobbies, you know, things that they might want to achieve or do in life. Some would even give up food and clothing so that their child would have what they needed, and they would refocus the purpose of their lives, almost, if you will, to focus on the people that now rely on them and the people that really care about them so much. This report a parent has with a child, I think, is godlike to a degree. To young children, parents are amazing beings, and they can bring forth food, and they have words of wisdom to share. They can find solutions to problems that they see no answer to, and they comfort them. They promote healing. And also, parents can unleash wrath from time to time. And all of these are aspects of God, actually, and his relationship to all of us. With this in mind, Proverbs 6 gives us a bit of insight as to this godly relationship between a father and a mother and their child. In Proverbs 6, in verse 20, the instructions are, "My son, keep your father's command, and do not forsake the law of your mother. Bind them continually upon your heart. Tie them around your neck. And when you roam, they will lead you. When you sleep, they will keep you. And when you awake, they will speak with you. For the commandment is a lamp, and the law a light. Reproofs of instruction are the way of life." And it goes on speaking about it's to keep you from evil and harm that will actually come to you. But what is the father's commandment here? I mean, we see that it's talking about a father and a mother as parental figures. But the father, he rules as what? We know the father is designated as the head of the family. And father's commandments are to be based on God's commandments. And what is the law of the mother? The law of the mother is to be based on the law of God. You know, don't tell a fib. And then, of course, there are personal things in there, you know, like pick up your dirty socks on the floor and wash behind your ears and eat your vegetables. But these are laws that are principles of living, that are for the well-being of the child. And they are laws that are both for moral health and physical health. And so these words are said to children, and they are to be from a father and a mother, and yet they should be in line with the instructions of God, the instructions God gave to all of his people. Deuteronomy 6, a parallel scripture here, there is this symbolism in the husband, wife, and family, the children, the symbolism of how the husband was designed to be a type of priest-like figure, a Christ-like figure, if you will, in the family, who would uphold the law, who would make sacrifices for his wife and children. And the wife is seen as a type of church who does something similar. And this is evident by Paul's instructions in Ephesians 5 when he said that this is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Now, there is, of course, personalized rules that parents might have, like don't run in the house and don't run with scissors. Keep your hands off of mommy's perfume. Don't play with the power saw. You're going to get hurt. But all of our parental instructions are to be in line, always to be in line with God's instructions. And this is clearly evident by some words printed in Deuteronomy 6. And beginning in verse 6, where it says, "These words which I command you today shall be in your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your children, and you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign in your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes, and you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." In other words, it's God's commandments, His laws, are to be the framework of our lives, the framework of a family. And the whole family relationships, all of the dynamics are to be established and considered in the light of God's law. Everything we put our hand to do and everything we think about with our minds. Now, the correlation between the commandment of the father and the law of the mother and the word of God is inextricably tied in this way. And so God instructs and He guides His people through His commandments. But His people are referred to as what? Children. We are referred to as children, the children of God. And so the law is to be taught to our children. Just as God teaches the law to us, we are to pass that down to our children. Titus in chapter 2, all the way back to Titus. I want to read this because I think it contains some principles that are for everyone. And it does relate to the relationships in a family and also to the relationships we have with each other in the church. So it says in chapter 2 and in verse 1, "You therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. And the things that you have heard from me among my witnesses, commit these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. You must be able to endure hardship as a good soldier of Christ." Oh, excuse me, I'm in Timothy. Somebody should have stopped me. So close together, and yet so far apart. Okay, Titus in chapter 2 and beginning in verse 1. "But as for you, speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine, that the older men be sober, reverent, temperate, sound in faith, in love, in patience. And the older women likewise, that they be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things. That they admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be blasphemed. Likewise, exhort the young men to be sober-minded. In all things, show yourself to be a pattern of good works and doctrine, showing integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that one who is an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say with you." So these are standards we see that are given to parents, but not just to parents. They are given actually to all adults and even to young people, standards that are to be upheld. And it says that they may teach, it says, the younger men, the younger women, how to behave. And if anyone does otherwise than what is stated here, it says it's to our shame. It's to our shame, and it will actually influence others to behave inappropriately. Proverbs 30. So because there are many families in this country and around the world that exhibit inappropriate behavior, ill behavior, if you will, it seems that dysfunctional families are the norm. In fact, psychologists with that are counseling with others, I have heard, ask the question, what is abnormal behavior? Trying to make the person feel better about themselves. It's like, well, maybe I'm really just normal. Everybody's a little abnormal. I think there's a little cute saying by a child once that said, nobody's normal. Everybody is weird. Of course, everybody except for me is weird. We all think that we're the normal people, and my wife kind of corrects me on that from time to time. In any case, the idea that, what's normal today and what's abnormal? Is anything actually normal? It sounds much like Pilate's response to Christ when he said, "What is truth? Is there really any truth out there?" It's craziness if you think about it. And is it any wonder that there are so many people with emotional problems and physical problems today? Because so many disobey. They disrespect their parents. And many even curse their parents today. And I think it's part of this is people are asking, well, what's normal? Nobody really knows what's normal. What's truth? What's right? What's wrong? Who's the judge of what's right and wrong today? And so it gives people an excuse to not really do what is right and not really seek for truth and look for what is good and what might be considered, in our minds, normal and appropriate behavior. So we can see that many children actually misbehave today. Many do not even trust their parents because their parents are fairly lukewarm, I should say, in their attitude and pretty a little too liberal in their ideals and what they allow to take place in their homes. And therefore, there are so many families out there that really don't trust in God. Proverbs 30 and verse 11, prophetic, I believe, where it says, "There is a generation that curses its father and does not bless its mother. There's a generation that is pure in its own eyes and yet is not washed from its filthiness." Well, we see that this is a perfect description of our generation today, a generation that curses the ideals of its forefathers, the ideals of its foremothers, if you will. And yet people think they are pure in their eyes, that this is the good thing to do, that we should accept any and all people, no matter what kind of deviance they might want to promote or try to display in the streets of the country, that we should have respect for them. I don't respect them at all. I mean, I may respect that they have an opinion, but that opinion is highly wrong and questionable. And so we are this generation, though, for the most part, that thinks they are pure in their own eyes. America still, I think, widely feels that it's the light of the world, but even though the light becomes more and more dim, and we're riddled with sin all over. I seen a billboard at one point that said, "You can be good without God." Really? Well, God is the one actually who defined what good is. So I highly think anybody can be good without God. There was another sign I saw on a bus at one point that said, "God probably does not exist, so enjoy your life." Whoa. As if life cannot be enjoyable when you worship the true God, the one who knows what's really good and profitable and helpful to us. It's really very, very sad. You know, we claim still, I think, to be a nation under God today. Politicians will throw this expression around, but I think we're widely filled with disobedience to God. And because of this, Mother's Day in this country today is not as it should be, but that should not affect us, who truly want to honor our parents. And as parents ourselves, we should be honorable and do what is right so that our children will look to us and desire to be like us. You know, imitate me as I imitate Christ, as Paul had stated. Harold Reynolds was the all-star second baseman for the Seattle Mariners. And in a short article in Sports Spectrum, he wrote this. He said, "When I was growing up in Corvallis, Oregon, there was an NBA player named Gus Williams. And Gus tied his shoes in back instead of in front." Ooh, I thought that was so cool. So I started tying my shoes in back. I wanted to be like Gus. He wore number 10, so I wore number 10. He wore one wristband, so I wore one wristband. One day, he said, "I was lying in bed on my stomach, and it was killing me. I noticed that it wasn't my sports hero, Gus Williams, who came to my room to take care of me. It was my mother. And that's when I began to understand the difference between heroes and role models," which really should be the same, I think. But he wrote, "I stopped looking at athletic accomplishments to determine who I wanted to pattern my life after. Instead, I tried to emulate people with strong character who were doing things of lasting value." And that is what parents should be to their children. People with strong character that are doing things of lasting value. Things that our children will want to do as they look at our example. Now, the fifth commandment says to honor your father and mother, and it's known as a commandment of promise because God says that he will make your days long in the land that you inherit if you honor your parents. Now, to honor, it means to respect. It means to listen to obey, to consider them as people of value and not disrespect them, to emulate even, or to imitate their behavior. And this is all, of course, within the context of God-fearing parents. You know, God feels so strongly about this that, as was mentioned in the reading by Randy Schock, that people who disrespected and dishonored their parents were put to death. And this was a harsh punishment, some might say. But it's because of what the parents portray. As explained, what do they portray? A father picturing Christ, the mother representing the church, and children in their wombs, like a mother carries a child as it develops, as it matures, being ready to be born. In the womb, it's not perfect. It needs a lot of development has to take place before it can be born. And so are those within the body of the church. We are all like children. Christ said we must be like children, in fact. You have to become like children, teachable, impressionable. And we are all immature in some way, and we are still waiting to become mature enough so that we might be able to be born a second time. Like the embryo and then the later fetus, as it is called, develops, we are developing and we are waiting. We are waiting for a spiritual birth into the kingdom of God. And that development includes learning how to be honorable people and learning how we should also honor our parents. And tomorrow we do have an opportunity to focus on one of these parents, our mothers. Now, all of us have a mother. All of us have a mother. Some have stepmothers and some have adoptive parents. Others have had mother and father type figures in their lives. Maybe their mother passed away when they were young, like my wife. And so we find people that are actually honorable, people that are respectable, and we look to them, and they help us. And they have helped us grow and mature in some way. And all of us have likely had mothers wait on us hand and foot while we were sick. We had meals prepared for us. We had our clothes washed and laid out for us to wear. We were given money to go to various activities. We were driven to school. We were taught lessons in life by nurturing people that were our parents and parental figures. And those of us who have become parents now, we realize, well, there are many, many things that our mothers did for us that went unnoticed and also unappreciated. And tomorrow we have a chance to go back and remember some of those things, to appreciate them. And though our parents may not have been perfect, and I'm sure none of them were, they had their share of faults. They made mistakes, just as we have made mistakes, but they are still our parents. And so we should forgive them if necessary. We should go back and honor them in some way because of who they are and what they meant to us. As imperfect as we all may be, we respect and honor the Father in heaven. We look to the law of the church, and we look to the Jerusalem above, which is the mother of us all. And much like our physical parents, who committed themselves to our upbringing, not just our birth, but our upbringing and good moral behavior and development, we see that the Father has committed himself to the birth of the sons of God, and Christ sacrificed much for this cause. And so remember what Christ did for us, and consider what our physical parents, our fathers and our mothers, have done for us. And so honor our parents. Give them due respect. Give them love. Show them kindness. And honor them in a way that God tells us we should.